This is Politics is Local, a special election time series of KHOI Community Radio. This week's program features the last of four candidate forums presented by the League of Women Voters of Ames and Story County. KHOI is very pleased to be partnering with the League for this broadcast series. This forum, held Monday, October 21st, brought together the candidates for State District 49. They included incumbent Dave Dio, Republican, Mickey Franklin, Democrat, John Evans, Libertarian, and Mike Knox, Independent. This was held in the Senior Center in Nevada and moderated by Becky Coates. This show will be aired again on Saturday morning at 9 a.m. and can also be found on our webpage, khoifm.org.
Probably one of the biggest frustrations we've seen through the legislature over the last few years is school funding. Seems like the budget takes forever to get passed. Teachers are pink-slipped because the administration doesn't know how their budgets will turn out. It seems like an ongoing frustration between the two houses. How will you, as a candidate, help improve this situation?
We'll start with Mickey.
Well, I already told you in my opening statement that I'm planning on going with the Senate. They want to do 4%. I am down for 4%. I have a daughter in the school district, and that's the last thing that I want to see is any of the teachers in this school district being cut. We have other smaller communities around us that I feel like we decrease funding any further, we're going to be shoving a lot of kids in a lot of small schools, and it's not going to work. And in order to keep that from happening, the funding has to be there for these small schools and for all schools. And that's my goal.
John?
I'd go ahead and agree with the 4% increase on spending, because if you fail your children, you aren't just potentially failing children of kids you don't know. You're failing the next generation of Iowans. So if we don't equip them properly to be able to handle the problems the future may hold, then we're really selling ourselves short. So I think our children here in Iowa are one of our biggest commodities, and we need to treat them as you'd want to be treated. We should provide them with quality education and make sure that they have the opportunities to succeed.
Mike?
I think we can all agree that education can be primary to our efforts, but I would be asking what's creating the situation where the budgets and the money and the information to the school is not being completed in a timely manner. What's creating that? And I think what I heard in another forum was that there's a difference between the viewpoints of the Democrats and Republicans. I sat in the forum and they basically pointed fingers at each other. That's what it felt like. So I would be working with everybody, with everyone, Democrat, Republican. It doesn't matter to me. I just want to do a good job, and I want to do good things for the people and for the kids. Our education has this spring again dropped in the national rankings, and I don't know what's creating that. We need to ask a lot of questions and find out why, because there are people with some answers to what that is. And sometimes it isn't always money, but I've talked to some school administrators, and money does make a difference. There's some school systems that are better off than some others. But even with that, the ranking decreasing may not be a function of funding. It may be how we're doing it and what we're doing. So I think we need to ask some very tough questions and see why were we at the top of the rankings previously and we're not there now. What has changed where we were better than what we're doing now and we're falling in our rankings? So we have to ask those questions. What have we done and what aren't we doing? And we need to support our teachers in every way possible.
Dave?
Well, let me first ask just hypothetically, what if, let's say a year ago when we were looking at funding and the same thing occurred and the Senate Democrats said we need to have 4% and the schools were arguing for 4%. What ended up happening was revenue actually went up about 3%. Well, actually, it was less than that because when we ended up agreeing finally at the end towards late, and I'll agree. We need to make that decision earlier, but actually House Republicans were at 2% for a long time. We were very adamant that we didn't have any more money than that. What we ended up agreeing on was 2.25%, so we just went up a quarter of a percent, and that basically ate up 77% of all of our new revenue. So you think about that. Schools are for approximately, K-12 is about 40% of all of the state funding. So now that left no money for mental health, for paying state employees in important departments like corrections, highway patrol. You know, there's a lot of other important priorities that we need to still fund. And we went as far as we possibly could, I think, this past year with the state revenue that we were giving. Because, like I said, 77% of the new money went to education. And you look over the last 6 years, we've increased funding for K-12 schools by over $600 million during that period. So schools have gotten probably, if you looked compared to any other state program, the only other program that may have increased as much is Medicaid. Funding for Medicaid is probably the only other thing that's competed with that kind of increases. And primarily the issue with Medicaid is the fact we were getting less money from the federal government because of the FMAP rate that we get from the feds. And part of it had to do with the fact that the state of Iowa, the economy was doing better than a lot of other states at the time. And so that caused the rate that the feds reimburse us at a lower rate. So we've got a lot of other competing programs that need to find funding, too. And so that's essentially why we ended up with that lower rate. Now, going forward, I don't know where we're going to be at for this coming year at this time, but hopefully we'll get a good revenue estimate in December, and that's what we have to base our budget on, is the revenue estimate in December.
Could I just have you add on to that and say, why was the budget so late? What can be done to improve when that budget is passed so schools know what they have to spend, so other units in government know what they have to spend? How can we accomplish that?
And Mike's not going to like this answer, but historically, if you look at the Senate and the House, when the Senate and the House have both been in the same party, they've made a timely decision. And it hasn't mattered whether it was Republicans or Democrat. The decision was timely when you had the same party. And the governor doesn't even matter, because back when Vilsack was governor, the decisions were made in a timely way when you had a Republican House and Senate. They made the decision. They sent the bill to the governor. Then it was up to the governor to decide whether to pass it or veto it. It's a function of the negotiations that end up happening between the House and the Senate. And the only idea that I've heard that I thought, you know, I heard this at another forum. I thought, well, that may be the only thing I've heard that might end up pushing this to get done faster, would be that if we didn't do any other business at all, we weren't allowed to do anything else. We just were required to just deal with the school funding first and nothing else. It would probably push our session longer, though, because there's a schedule that we put all the bills on, and with regards to deadlines when bills have to be passed out of committee and things like that, and it would push that deadline back. It would probably mean our sessions would have to go, you know, another 3 weeks to a month longer, maybe. But then you would have other entities that would be waiting in June for us to get the. But schools would know sooner, obviously. But counties might be in a situation on certain things. There might be other local entities that might be also waiting for other answers on funding.
Ma'am. John.
In the private sector, if you don't do your job, there are reprimands that you can get up to losing your job. So I think if you, as a party or even as an organization, can't get bills passed to literally fund schools for our kids, then we should start taking away some of your own privileges. We should pass a law of some type that says by this calendar date, and then every year after that, you know, by this date, we have to have a budget set. Because it's not like we're starting school in random months where it's kind of hard to work these things in. We know approximately when school starts and school ends. It can't be too terribly hard to say, hey, if we don't get this, we're selling the future short. These are kids. It's not like, and these kids don't even have representation to talk to legislatures about this. So it's really, to me, I think, pass a law, say get it done. Don't sit around and also compromise with the other party. If you're sitting deadlock, be the first person to budge. You don't have to wait and hold out for party unity. Get it done.
Mike?
Yeah, John makes a good point in regards to being timely on this. And correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, but there are some time constraints in this number coming out, and they haven't been met in the past. So there's times when it goes past that time that it's supposed to be available. Is that that's true, isn't it, Dave?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. So, but there isn't any punishment, or there isn't anything that happens if the numbers aren't available or not made available. So, again, it comes back to the parties working together, and that's what I'll do if I'm there. I'll work with everyone. We just want to solve that and get it done. And if the money isn't available, well, you can't allocate money if it isn't there. And our budget is over 40% of the general fund goes to our education, 40%. And if we can't focus on that and get a job done for the kids, you know, that why isn't that a priority enough to it should be a priority enough right there to get the job done. It really should.
Mickey?
Yeah, I understand what everybody is saying up here. Unfortunately, I can't comment more on what can be done to make this done any faster. I haven't been at the State House. I don't know what the floor looks like. I don't know what time constraints are. But I firmly agree that it needs to happen day one. I literally feel it needs to happen day one. But again, everybody has to work on getting closer to a number that benefits everybody in a whole. And if you're going to sit for months and months and months, or put it off for months because nobody is budging from either side, this is the frustrating part about it. I'm having different parties and numbers thrown everywhere, and we just have to think about what is best for Iowa, not what's best for your party, not what you personally feel inside as a person, but what is best for the state of Iowa. And getting this done in a timely manner and faster is better. So, but like I said, I can't comment on any more of what I can personally do until I'm there.
Could I respond on a couple of things that were brought up? First of all, there is a penalty overall when we don't pass the budget. We get to the end of 100 days or 110 days in a non-election year, and we don't get paid our per diem. So there is a penalty.
But Dave, that penalty isn't tied directly to the budget for the school.
Not for schools,
okay,
no. But it
in
is
general,
for the overall. If we run too long overall, you know, so that forces both parties to get to work together. I also point out that everything that we've passed in the last 6 years has been bipartisan, because everything has had to pass through the Senate, and it's had to pass through the House, and it's had to be signed by the governor. So there's nothing that we've done for the last 6 years that hasn't been bipartisan. Then I wanted to also, you know, mention too that if one side is adamant that you have to have 4%, let me put it this way. As Republicans, what's the political advantage for us to stick to 2%? We have no political advantage. There's no group out there that's coming to us and say, by gosh, don't fund schools. There's no political advantage. The only reason we do it is because it's the fiscally responsible thing to do. We don't have the money. So the only person that's playing political, the only folks that are playing political games with this is the Democrats, because their biggest interest group is the teachers union, and that's why they push for 4%, or 6%, whether we have the money or not. They're the ones that have a political advantage in this fight, not us. We don't. There's nobody out there that's telling us that we should spend less on schools. That's the point I wanted to make on that issue.
I see that there are some. We'll start with Mike this time.
It sounds like there wouldn't be enough new revenue to go to four.
No, there wouldn't have been. We couldn't. We literally, okay. The only way to have done it would have been to spend more than we were taking
in. So the political advantage in that, I'm sorry, the political advantage in that is that we don't have enough revenue coming in. If you want to spend money, you got to have revenue coming in, or you don't get to spend it. So from that standpoint, revenue needs to come in. If we're going to do something about that and not trim somewhere else, taxes have to go up, I believe. I mean, revenue comes in and you can spend more. So there is an advantage to not, a political advantage to not raising taxes.
And John, would you like to comment?
Yeah, once again, I'd like to bring up how we have money to send SWAT teams over grams of pot. We have money to send these non-violent drug users to jail and spend tens of thousands of dollars a year sending them to minimum sentencing. But we don't have money to fund schools. It's almost like there's money for things that the Republicans and the Democrats want to do, but there's no money to actually help anybody because it is political. If you want to get reelected as a Republican, you got to keep taxes low. You got to give businesses what they want when they want it. And it's the same thing with the Democrats. You got to lay down for the unions. It just doesn't make sense to me that we have money for for-profit prisons, but we don't have money to put our kids through school. So let's empty out the prisons from these nonviolent offenders. And let's reinvest in school. And if we can also take a page from Colorado and legalize pot and tax it, then we can fund our schools via that way too. We have great examples of how to get things done, but we need leadership that's ready for the 21st century, and I don't think the Democrats or the Republicans have it for us.
So a number of counties have taken up the issue of raising the minimum wage. What are your thoughts on that?
Let's start with Mickey.
Well, I definitely would like to see an increase of the minimum wage. I would love to see it a little bit above $15 an hour. And a lot of people have asked me why that amount. And if my gentleman up here attended some of the forums for the poverty forums that we all should have been to, they'd know that a little above $15 is a little above poverty. So, and poverty is what I hold near and dear to my heart. And we have a lot of people who need state assistance, and that $15 an hour or a little above will let them still have that assistance that they need. But my goal is to slowly wean them off of it where they don't need to sufficiently live on state funding forever. And I mean, when you think about it, a person graduates college like me 2 years ago. I have $50,000 in student loans, and my minimum payment every month is $500. That's crazy. I have a mortgage payment that's, you know, $800 a month. I have a car payment, two car payments. I have to live, and at $9 an hour, there's no way that anybody would be able to make, nobody would be able to do that. And just because I graduated college doesn't mean that I'm out there making $50 an hour. So knowing that I want to raise the minimum wage to just a little bit lower than what I'm currently making as a college graduate is crazy to me. It is a crazy idea, but it's fair. And I firmly believe that everybody deserves something, and that's where I want to see it.
John?
The problem with raising the minimum wage, especially almost 100% increase or over 100% increase, is that once you start raising that minimum wage, the first people to be left behind are people with little to no experience, people with who are developmentally delayed, and minorities and people of color. So we really have to watch out for, if we rapidly raise the minimum wage, it's another problem that's really going to face our youth more than anything, is because why, if you're, if, If the price for you to employ someone nearly doubles, are you going to try and waste the money on training somebody and getting somebody employed? Or are you going to say, let's skip all the people with little to no experience and let's hire the people with the most experience? I agree that the current minimum wage right now is too low, but we have to watch out for our small business owners so we don't put them under when we double the minimum wage. Another thing I think would potentially go a long way with this, I know we don't have a choice in the matter locally here in Iowa, but there is a growing body of evidence economically that we could have a reverse income tax or universal basic income. Because for every family of four in poverty, we spend about $89,000 a year in federal funds trying to lift them out of poverty. We have like a dozen different welfare programs spread across the federal government and paying for the bureaucracy to do it. And so if we could push a universal basic income to the federal government and or a reverse income tax, whatever you want to call it, we could keep minimum wage at $7 an hour if there's universal basic income and people will be able to live. Because you'll still get money from the government. We could erase the bureaucracy that the Fed set up and then keep minimum wage low. That way the employers can focus more on serving their product or service and keeping their cost of business low. So I think it's a real slippery slope once you start going down that $15 minimum wage. I myself actually make less than that right now. I'm a middle-low class running for office. So it's just one of those things where it always sounds good until you start seeing what happens. So I think if we're going to do it, we have to do it very incrementally. You can't raise it, double it in a span of even 5 to 10 years. I think it'd be too big of a hardship with inflation. So maybe baby steps before we start making people run for it.
Mike?
Minimum wage, I believe, for the most part, supply and demand is setting that today, because there's a large number of employers that I look at as entry level jobs that are paying $9 and $10 an hour. There's a number of those, and we have some very good employers here in the state that are doing that. Take a look at maybe like the convenience store industry, and look at the signs in the window. Those wages are in that range now. So I'm looking at that as an entry-level job. I would want to hear which are the employers that are paying the minimum wage right now. I'd like to hear what industry that is, where are those people, and what impact that would have to the employer if they're forced to increase that minimum wage. And if we increase the minimum wage, it will have a bit of a ripple effect in the cost of goods and services that we pay for. It will. And are we willing to do that in order to achieve a minimum wage? And if those prices go up, does that then make our poverty level increase? So it there's a potential, it feels like, for a snowball effect. Raise the minimum wage. Raise the goods and services provided that they provide, that those prices have to go up. So now the minimum wage has to go back up to cover the cost of that. So we need to be careful with that, but we do need to be sensitive to what those industries are that are paying the 7.25 today and who the people are that are working those, because I believe in many cases we have high school students maybe that are taking those minimum wage jobs, and I think it's okay for in some cases they're not looking to get out of the poverty level necessarily. They're looking for some experience, they're looking for some gas money, and I think in some cases that's okay. So I think we have to be careful with how we approach that and what we do.
Dave.
Yeah, thank you for the question. I wanted to point out, first of all, that John and I did attend the Poverty Forum over in Ames. And I'm going to say the same thing that I said there. A couple of the comments, the last two, I agreed with a lot of what they said. Let me go at it from even a different angle, because Mickey brought up, families in particular and kids, families with kids. Most of the programs that we have in the state of Iowa that are, what we used to call welfare, most of those are federal programs. And, you know, sometimes you may think it's a state program because it's state administered, but it's actually a federal program that's federal rules and paid for by the feds. And so programs like the child care subsidy, for example, and some things like that, and even the earned income tax credit that is on the income taxes, we have a state version of that, but it's much smaller than the feds. The feds is the main one. So I think there's a financial incentive for the feds to raise the minimum wage because they actually would lower some of those costs on some of those programs. But here in the state of Iowa, for us to raise it, all as we're doing is basically now making single parents not eligible for some of those programs because you've just pushed their income level up enough to where now they no longer qualify. I did some really in-depth research into this, and I had an LSA staffer working on this for quite a while for me a couple of years ago when this issue first came up. And he was looking. I had him. It's very tricky to figure out because there's so many variables. You know, how many kids? What are the income levels? What exactly is the living situation? What town? Where do they live? A lot of these things make a difference. But I just had some hypotheticals. Let's say it's a single mother with two kids, and what I discovered was that a single mother with two kids earning the minimum wage right now, if she is taking all of the primarily, like I said, federal, but a few state programs that she's eligible for, she's actually her actual income, if you look at all the money she has coming in, is a little over $40,000 if you add it all up. So you raise that minimum wage, and essentially what you're going to do is you actually lower the amount of assistance that she's going to get. You're going to save the feds some money, but it doesn't really benefit. Doesn't benefit the state in any way. It doesn't benefit that individual mother in any way, other than she may ask to work fewer hours, and that's really what happens. Is there's a economist that overnames it, Peter Rosm, who I really admire. The guy, I think he's really does a good job and everything. He's actually a Democrat. He did some research on this. There was a period when Iowa had a lower rate or a higher minimum wage than the states around us for a short period of time. And what his research showed was that there was no net increase in income. It was just you had lost hours on one side, and some people benefited by higher pay, but a lot of people either weren't hired or had lower hours. So I think it's a wash. You know, really. I'm not necessarily violently opposed to it. I just don't think it's that beneficial.
You are listening to Politics is Local, a special election time series on KHOI Community Radio.
As many of you know, criminal justice reform is a big thing going across the nation. And one of the components of that reform is banning the box. Would you support legislation that would prohibit employers, future employers, from asking the question about a person's criminal convictions? And if you would tell me why you would support or why you would not support that legislation.
We'll start with Mike.
Support legislation to not ask those questions?
Not have it appear on the at the initial application.
The initial application. Mm-hmm.
It would be further in the hiring. That question could be asked further in the hiring process.
And that would prevent an employer from not visiting with a person because of that? Is that
yes,
the intent?
Yes.
So that you at least you sit down and talk a little bit.
Exactly.
Yeah. I work at a company where we have 30 employees, and there could be as many as... there could be as many as 10 felons working with us. And if we don't give them a second chance, there's been some successes and there's been some failures. That's people, I believe. So if we as employers don't at least sit down and visit a little bit, I think we're missing an opportunity to allow a person a second chance. I guess I wouldn't necessarily be opposed to it. allowing that information to not be on the initial? I think that's your question. So I'm not necessarily opposed to that. But I would also, again, I want to know what the voters want. I want to know what the people want. What are the majority of the voters in this district, what would they want? And I know we can't ask that question on every single thing. And I can't defer that to every single thing. But I'd ask what the people would, how they want to do it. I'd ask employers. I'd ask those people that interview. But that's how I do feel that it would be okay not to ask that question up front. I do think it'd be okay.
Dave?
I think really, you know, part of the reason that's behind this is there's an inequity, of minorities that are in prison. So that's one of the things that they're hoping that would have more employment of minorities and that sort of thing. And I just wanted to caution you. I just saw a study that came out recently that we get a number of different magazines that are sent to us that are I think this one was called Governing, which is it goes out to all state representatives around the and government folks around the nation. And they did a study of the states that have passed this. There's probably about 15 to 20 states that have passed this, is my recollection. I don't remember the exact number, but what they discovered was that hiring rates for minorities actually declined after that was passed. Why that happened, they don't know, but it's sort of like a cautionary note that they're saying, well, wait a minute, watch out, passing these. There may be some problem with this that's causing something that's going on. So I'm willing to look at it and take a look at it. I don't have a huge problem with it, but I think one of the things that I think will occur is a lot of employers have other ways they can look up somebody's criminal past without, they don't necessarily have to rely with what's on the box on the form. So there are other ways to look up people's criminal past. So I don't know if that was occurring in some of those states, and they're finding people that have a criminal record that didn't. I don't know. I'm not sure exactly why. And the people doing the study didn't know what was causing this either. So I think, I agree with the people should get a second chance. We got this great program that we've funded here that's through it's called, the name of the program is going to slip my mind, but it involves Story and Polk County counties primarily. And it was the Amos Group is the ones that started it, got the ball rolling on it. But it's a program that takes people that are very difficult to employ, primarily people with criminal records and that sort of thing. And they basically bring them in, give them some lifestyle training, tell them this is how you should behave at work. This is what your employer will expect. Just basic things that some of these people just don't really understand how to get and hold a job. And then they actually hook them up with an employer. And it's been a very successful program.
Mickey?
I don't know a lot about, I know that it is standard on most applications. I don't know if a lot of employers look at it and base their judgment on that question, but I can tell you that my internship, I worked with the homeless youth in Des Moines, in downtown Des Moines, and we set them up. Most of the homeless youth in Des Moines that I worked with had criminal backgrounds, and we did have an entity that had at least 15 pages worth of employers in Des Moines that would hire people that had a criminal background no matter what. And the reason why I think I would vote against it is because employers don't want to waste people's time, and people don't want to waste employers' time. So when I think about like my past and people that I know, if you're a convicted felon, why would you be applying at a pawn shop, right? They sell guns. You're not allowed to be around guns. So for me, as a small business, I can see where they're not necessarily not talking to that person, but they get to have a little bit more background when they sit down with them and say, hey, I see that you have crossed this off on here. Can you tell me more about it? And then that helps them in their hiring process. But I think leaving it on there or taking it off, I mean, mostly leaving it on there, it helps everybody.
John?
I also would not support legislation to take that question off because it seems like an undue burden upon employers to say, hey, we're the government, we're here to help, we're going to tell you what you can have on your application to get a job and what you can't have anymore. I think a big part of this is, once again, getting back to the drug war. If you are African-American here in Iowa, you are 8 times more likely to be arrested for pot possession than your white counterparts, even though usage rates are about the same. Dealer rates among white people is actually higher than the minority population. So we see this great school-to-prison pipeline, and then we turn these poor kids who decided to roll a J one day and get high and watch cartoons and eat Cheetos, and we turn them into lifelong criminals because they do have a felony on their background, and it creates higher rates of recidivism. So I think if we want to end this problem, we really need to look at not what's on the job application, but what's sending these kids to jail. So to me, it's less of what should be on the application and more of, why are we putting kids in jails? Why are we giving them lifelong criminal records? I'd say another part of that is, if you are a nonviolent or a nonviolent sexual criminal, after you've served your time, you should, after a period of years, maybe 5-10 years, if you've been clean and no further incidents, we should expunge your record. It doesn't make sense that we should have these mistakes that people could have made when they were kids follow them around for the rest of their lives. So I'd like to see something like that happen, or full restoration of rights. If you're a nonviolent offender here in Iowa, you don't have the right to vote anymore unless you petition the government. And I think it's a slap in the face to say, well, you know, we put humans in cages, literal cages, and tell them what to do for years of their life. And then when they get out, you still don't have your rights. Sorry about it. And so to me, it's more of a question of, how can we stop putting humans in cages and get them jobs? And we need to take a top-down look at the criminal justice system and see what we can do to give Iowans their futures back.
Something I notice often in government when we talk about whether a program works is we really talk about outputs rather than outcomes. An output may be so many people got served, or so much money got put into a program, or so many activities happened. An outcome means we met our goal. We did what we wanted to get done. I would like each of you to address Iowa's nutrient reduction strategy in terms of what outcomes rather than simply outputs. Thank you. The nutrient reduction strategy is Iowa's plan to clean up our water, basically, to reduce the amount of nitrate, phosphorus, other farm chemicals that are going into our water. It is a voluntary plan. It provides some monies to farmers for certain practices. And Dave's probably going to correct me on something, but just in general, here's what we've got. And the goal is supposed to be to clean up our waters and also to have less of these farm chemicals from our watershed, going into the Mississippi River and going into the Gulf of Mexico, where we have a dead zone. I think it's the size of, it's one small eastern state. I always forget if it's Rhode Island or Connecticut, but it's getting larger. So Iowa's a big part of that problem. So in terms of outcomes, what do you look at in terms of the nutrient reduction strategy being a voluntary plan? Is it, what are the outcomes that it's supposed to be making, or is it?
We'll start with John.
I think I heard on Iowa Public Radio either last week or the week before about how this voluntary measure isn't really working. And when you are defacing the environment, you really should look at outcome. And part of that is, I think we have subsidies for farmers, so helping that boom happen, put more stuff in the water, We should look at potentially ending farm subsidies and let the free market handle it. And we could reroute some of that money to schools or to help mental health facilities or wherever it could go in the general budget. So I think number one is the people who are polluting our rivers need to be held accountable. You don't have the right to destroy someone else's water or air or soil. So it's really not necessarily a private property rights issue, but it's kind of the tragedy of the commons. Everybody saw it happen, and nobody did anything until it was too late. So we need to focusing whenever any government program is passed, you really need to focus on the real results instead of hoping and wishing and praying that the government's going to work successfully this time. Because whenever you look at the government, it's always usually promises. And when you try and suggest something new, they want guarantees. And it's unrealistic. So I think, yeah, we definitely need to look at getting it cleaned up. The voluntary measure has failed, so we need to try something that's not voluntary.
Mike?
Well, I'd want to look at the voluntary program and see what the results have been so far. I'd like to see that, if there's been an impact in the right direction. It doesn't feel like there is, because we had a record number of lakes in the state of Iowa that were declared hazardous this last year. So it could be an unusual year, but I think I feel like it's a trend. So we need to look at the sources, and we need to try to understand what the impact of the potential solutions at the source and what that would do. Because farmers, you can point the finger at farmers. It's an easy thing to do, but they have to be one of the major users of the nitrates that are getting into our water. I mean, it makes sense that they are. So we'd have to give them incentive not to do that. We need to educate best practices and try to encourage those. So I think it's a combination of things that can have positive outcomes in the system. And I know that dead zone in the Gulf is obviously an indicator of how bad it is. And I know that Iowa is one of the major contributors to that. So we need to look at what are the other alternatives for farmers to be as productive as possible and still be responsible as we can be. And the level today is not acceptable. We need to seriously look at what other things need to be put in place so that we can feel safe going to the lakes this summer and not have to worry about trying to find out have they been declared hazardous today or not. That we shouldn't have to go look.
Dave?
Linda, you actually did a really pretty good job of describing the nutrient strategy. Only small quibble that I would have with it is on the size of the dead zone. It shrinks and grows every year. Some years it's larger, some years it's smaller. And the reason is because if we have major flooding, for example, up here in the Midwest, you might remember back in 93, there was a huge increase in the dead zone because of all of the water that flowed out into the Gulf. And that sort of goes, lets me segue into one of the problems with measuring results on this program is because it's so weather related. From year to year, the weather can make a huge difference. And we had an individual that came in that's doing a lot of water quality studies. He's actually measuring water, nutrient levels and waterways all across Iowa, and he's looked at studies. And there's some existing data, not enough. I wish we'd have been doing more sampling, for the last 30 years. Because I think what you would have seen was a little more evidence that things are actually getting better, even though, the headlines tout when things have gotten worse one year. He actually pointed out, he says, over the time, and he says, you need to take the longest period of time possible, because if you take a shorter period of time, you can skew the results by what year you start and end the study. But he said in general, across most of the states, the levels are either steady or declining. The only place in Iowa where they're having an increase over a long period of time is a few rivers in western Iowa for some reason, and he didn't know why that was. I wanted to point out aspect of water quality here in Iowa that we know we can measure, and that is the number of streams in Iowa that can support trout. 30-some years ago, we had only 3 streams in Iowa that could support trout for trout fishing, and through voluntary efforts over several decades, we're up to now where we're 80 streams across the state right now that actually can support trout. And so that's an example of how volunteer efforts have worked. The thing I like about the nutrient reduction strategy is one leg that doesn't get a lot of attention is the work that Iowa State does. And part of the reason why I think it's a good program, if we had started a couple of years ago, let's say, and said, let's pass some regulations on farmers because we think farmers are the main reason for this, and obviously we know it's got to be the nitrogen that we're putting on corn. Makes sense. I mean, logically, it would seem like that would make sense. They just had a study that came out here just recently that was several researchers from, I think, Iowa State and University of Iowa that discovered that actually there's more nitrates coming off of soybean ground. Actually soybean ground, which farmers don't put any nitrogen on soybean ground during those soybean year. And the reason is because the real problem is ground that has nothing growing on it for 6 months out of the year. It's what happens in those other months. And you have all the time there's nitrogen that's in the soil. It's natural. It occurs in Iowa soil naturally. There's nitrogen there that is constantly always becoming water-soluble. Over time, it will become water-soluble. And then if there's nothing there to tie that nitrogen up, it allows it to leach, into the groundwater, into tiles, and that sort of thing. And so that's why the scientific part of this is important, that we actually have some real studies and we really know what works and what doesn't work. And that's one of the reasons why I support the nutrient strategy.
Mickey?
I'm just going to say the greatest thing about having a government is that if you don't know anything about the topic, you shouldn't say anything. So I am not educated enough on the topic, Linda. I want to answer your question, but I
if the Iowa legislature had been given the task of deciding on the Bakken pipeline instead of the Iowa Utility Board, how would you folks, if you all had been in the legislature, how would you vote? Folks have voted and why?
We'll start with Mickey.
I'm kind of torn because I don't know a lot about it. I hear one side and I hear another side, and I hear good points on both sides. And so to me, I'm really not at liberty to be able to answer that.
John?
I would have voted against it. I don't think using eminent domain so a private company can make money is a good idea at all. I'm also not excited to see the first time that this pipeline ruptures and dumps 10,000 gallons of oil onto the ground and onto our farmland or rivers and streams. It's purely a case of crony capitalism. There's the government says, okay, this one company, it's a monopoly now because the government is the one who said, okay, go ahead and go take some land. So it's a government-sponsored monopoly. And it uses threat of violence to take land away from Iowans. And the worst part about having, in some cases, just a direct democracy is 51% can rule over 49%. And that's why we're not a direct democracy in the U.S. I would have definitely voted against it. I don't think we should be literally taking land away from Iowans and giving it to a pipeline. And then just say, well, your neighbors wanted it, so now you have it, even if you didn't want it.
Mike?
Yeah, can you imagine owning the land and being told that that's going to happen to yours? Ownership of property, I'm not in favor of the private sector being able to do that. And I think it's interesting that there wasn't more of an outcry about it. I don't know how – I didn't hear that much about it. So it's interesting that it felt like it was quietly done, and it was a done deal, and it happened, and it's in the ground right now. And I mean, they're leveling it off and making it all nice and pretty down through this district that we've got. I'm concerned about the longevity of it also. I hope this company has a reserve for when that does happen, John. I really hope they have a reserve in place. They weren't required to make a reserve. I wonder why that wasn't put in place. I have a lot of questions, don't I? I don't know.
Just in response to one thing that you said, Mike, that they do have insurance. I mean, they've got very good. Very high rates of, you know, levels of insurance.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that.
So, and of course, they would have had to get the, you know, the risks and stuff would have had to been looked at by the folks with the insurance company to decide whether it was a good risk for them or not. One of my biggest concern, and I'm not a big fan of eminent domain, when this was first announced that something would happen similar to what almost happened up in northern Iowa or north of my district. There was a overhead power line that was supposed to go through. What happened with them was they were offering payments that were very low. They didn't really come up with a lot of money for the landowners, and so a lot of landowners were turning them down and saying, "No way, I'm not going to let you put that through my ground, and it's overhead lines. I'll not be able to fly airplanes anymore to put on to spray the crops. I can't or plant or whatever you're going to do with planes. There's multiple problems with it, and so they came to the utilities board and petitioned to get the right to have eminent domain, and they were turned down, at least partly because they, I think they were something like 15 or 20% was all they had signed up. What happened with this Bakken pipeline was by the time they went to the utility board, I think they were already over 85% signed up. And I know of one anecdotal story where another legislator was told by somebody, stop this thing no matter what. And then 6 months later, he saw her and said, oh, we've got a bill that we're working on this. And she says, no, I want it now because we've been taken care of. Yeah. So my understanding is that the payments were a minimum of about $16,000 an acre. So if you think about that, you know, the land's probably worth $10,000. So it's not too difficult to say, well, hey, that's why we're going to go ahead and take that payment because it's going to pay us even more than what the land is worth. So on one side, I'm not crazy about the idea of having an eminent domain, and there's a question whether this company is actually a utility because utilities are given eminent domain rights here in Iowa. And for obvious reasons, you know, if they're running an electric line through somewhere, they want to be able to serve electrical customers up and down the road, you know. And this is a little bit different where there's not any – it's sort of a little bit more – it's not as direct, you know. Yes, some of us will probably buy gas and oil from the oil that went through that line, but it's actually passing through Iowa down to New Orleans and then or wherever it's going, and then it'll eventually, you know – some of that gas will probably come back here. Some of it probably be exported. I don't know. But so anyway, there's some good arguments on both sides of this issue. Maybe in the end I might have voted for it, but I'm not, you know, if early on when it first came out, I probably would have voted no just, you know, because I would have assumed that maybe it wasn't going to go good for the landowners. But I think actually the landowners got treated pretty well. So. And I think from a safety standpoint, it's kind of a wash a little bit. There was a discussion about a break, but we have trains going through Iowa right now that have oil loaded on them that's coming from the same place that's going on railroads. Yeah. And those can just fall right off the tracks and break open. There's been some bad accidents in places like up in Canada with train cars exploding and you know, ripping open and stuff. So.
That's all we have time for on Politics is Local on KHOI Community Radio, a special election time series. This week's program featured the last of four candidate forums put on by the League of Women Voters of Ames and Story County. KHOI is very pleased to be partnering with the League for this broadcast series. This forum, held Monday, October 21st, brought together the candidates for State District 49. They included incumbent Dave Dio, Republican, Mickey Franklin, Democrat, John Evans, Libertarian, and Mike Knox, Independent. This was held in the Senior Center in Nevada and moderated by Becky Coates. This show will be aired again on Saturday morning at 9 a.m. and can also be found on our webpage, khoifm.org.